On Death, Sex, and Money, we feature interviews with you, our community of listeners, getting honest about uncomfortable things.
I developed an illness where it isn't safe for me to drive. A friend once said to me, "Sex is like air. You don't think about it until you're not getting enough." This is a similar sort of thing if you just replace sex with driving.
Listen to Death, Sex, and Money wherever you get podcasts.
Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its author's intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special 2-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
My colleague, Eamon Ismail, has always felt different, all his life. Even though he grew up in Newark, New Jersey, playing basketball and mixing it up with the other first-generation American kids in his neighborhood, he felt different. And it's because his Muslim community told him he was different and told him to be confident in his difference.
It was like stupid stuff, like, well, you guys are Muslim, so therefore you do not drink alcohol. You don't eat pork, and you don't curse, and that you respect your parents, and you don't date and then have sex and then get married. You get married first. For us, it was very much, you're Muslim, you live life this way, and that's very different than anybody else that you're going to meet out there.
Eamon is a staff writer at Slate Magazine. I love it when he tells stories about his parents. They've popped up in his journalism from time to time. His folks came to the States from Egypt. They worked really hard, raised 4 kids, sent them all to a private school that would teach the kids Arabic and make them study the Quran.
The school I went to was called Al Ghazali. It's this private Muslim Islamic school out in the middle of the hood in Jersey City. In a lot of ways, it was like this insular, separate community from the rest of like civil society at that time. You know, we did everything there from learning to read the Quran to, you know, like we had like a basketball league between all the other Islamic schools. We also had like a karate league. I got first place. I'm not showing off. I'm just saying it's true. And we also had like camping and we had like Islamic Boy Scouts. I mean, financially, it made no sense to send any of us there. You know, my dad worked as a driver in New York City. My mom actually had to take a job at that school to be an Arabic teacher just so that she can get us the discount, you know. And still, it was like a struggle. It was a struggle. But that's just, I think, in my parents' mind, all worth it to raise Muslim kids in America.
So was your family expecting you to graduate from that school?
Yeah. My whole family, all of us, all the siblings were all expected to graduate from that school, but I didn't. My last day there was September 11th.
day of the 9/11 attacks, Ayman was 11 years old. He remembers being evacuated from his school building, getting into a school bus, going down a highway, seeing the smoke from the Twin Towers. He remembers going home, waiting to hear from his dad, who spent his days driving people around in Lower Manhattan. He remembers watching the news on TV.
We're watching, I don't remember what, it might have been ABC or something.
This is as close as we can get to the base of the World Trade Center. You can see the firemen assembled here, the police officers, FBI agents, and you can see the two towers. A huge explosion now, raining debris on all of us. We better get out of the way.
And they were streaming from the street. They had live shots of people running from the debris and these huge clouds of smoke chasing people. And me being glued to the TV set looking for my dad. I'm trying to find him. And it wasn't until the next day, like a full 24 hours later, that my dad did eventually walk through the door. He walked from New York, which is crazy to think about.
After that, Ayman's school didn't reopen right away. There was a fear that it would be unsafe, a target for anti-Muslim sentiment in the wake of the attacks. So Ayman's parents gave him an option to start going to his local public school in Newark. And Ayman took it. And he never set foot in his Muslim school again.
Never. Not for anything.
What was the discussion about that?
I mean, it's hard to say because my parents never sat me down and gave us like a 9/11 talk. Like, that never happened. But I could tell that they were thinking, the school is going to be closed. The nature of going to a Muslim school in this country is going to be different. What are we willing to roll the dice on?
People talk about the U.S. losing a sense of stability on 9/11. What did you lose as a kid, as a Muslim American?
What did I lose on 9/11? I mean, everything. Everything. No, seriously, like everything. The Muslim community that I was a part of, it was a community that I'd been part of since I was born. And I would never see almost any of them ever again. Because I'm not the only one who left. So I would say the community never fully recovered from 9/11 in that sense, where there was this huge earthquake beneath the ground that just pushed everybody out.
Today on the show, the flip side of the war on terror and how it shook the life of one Ayman Ismail, a Muslim, an Arab American, a kid. I'm Mary Wilson, in for Mary Harris. This is What Next. Keep listening.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
You have written about listening to President George W. Bush in the weeks after 9/11, and he made these speeches ensuring the country that, you know, the war against terrorism is not a war against Muslims, nor is it a war against Arabs.
The face of terror is not the true faith of Islam. That's not what Islam is all about. Islam is peace.
I mean, you were just a kid, but do you remember hearing those words at the time? And did they give you any kind of solace?
Yeah, they did. Yeah, I remember those words very clearly. I mean, when he gave that speech from an Islamic center just days after 9/11, my parents, particularly my dad, talked about how relieved he felt. And he thought that we had just averted a whole disaster of a cultural phenomena. he was incredibly relieved, and that gave me relief as his son. It's just that that was before we knew about the Patriot Act and this idea of like the war on terror. And so our community felt great about those comments. But then when the Patriot Act came out, we were like, oh, man, this is going to change everything.
The Patriot Act passed within a couple months of the attacks on 9/11. It was meant to allow U.S. intelligence agencies to share information to prevent future acts of terrorism. But the law also made it easier for the government to surveil American citizens, and it relaxed the rules around federal law enforcement searching people's homes.
A year after 9/11, this was like 2002, and like a whole squad of FBI showed up to our door in Newark, New Jersey, with guns drawn and flashlights in the middle of the night at like 4 a.m. My mother was already awake because it was like the dawn prayer time. This is the time that Muslims pray before the sun comes up. And so they must know, this must be part of like their handbook, where if like if someone's an immigrant, they're going to pretend like they're on your side and they're just going to ask for permission very politely. Can we come inside? Because they know they don't have a warrant. And so my mom saw the guns. She saw the flashlights. She saw the jackets with FBI written on them. And she was like, yeah, we have nothing to hide. Come on in. And as soon as she said that, they like rush past her and they start just like tearing the place apart.
Did you ever find out why they were there?
I don't know. They told my mom that they were looking for someone named Muhammad Muhammad, which is like the most common name in the world. So like even to us, it's like cartoonish. Like, does this person exist? Who knows? But no, obviously they're not going to find someone like that, especially if they're digging through like children's clothes and like taking my toys and dumping the box and going through the kitchen drawers. Like they went through everything. And then when they were done, they left and didn't really say anything. So, you know, I'm a little kid. I'm 12 at this point. I'm waking up in the middle of the night and people are shuffling through my room that I have no idea with guns. What am I supposed to think? How am I supposed to feel? Like, you tell me.
I don't know. If that had happened to me, I would just be, I would go through my next year with like a cloud over me, like someone can come into my house at any time and I'm a suspect in something. That would be very destabilizing. How did your parents go forward after that?
You know, and I think a lot of parents can relate to this. They must have hid it very well because they thought they had to. Like my parents were very good at trying to protect us from fear and like, and all of those like bad feelings. So my dad was, at least in that moment and in front of us kids, being like the overly cooperative person and being like, look, kids, we have nothing to hide. Let's help these people find whatever they're looking for. They're good people. Cops are here to protect us. And I remember very distinctly in that moment, my mom comforting us and kind of like putting her arms around us while they were going through the rest of the house and telling us that this is like a good thing and they're just trying to keep us safe.
Did anybody in your family try to insist on getting an explanation for why this happened or even in years after try to figure out or bring it up, you know, just to talk about it? Like, why did that happen to us?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, you got to remember, like, this is like one of many different kinds of experiences. So like it happens so regularly. It also happened to people that we knew where it just felt like it was par for the course and part of like the American experience. Right. And so we just wanted to move past it. I wanted to move past it. And at a certain point, I almost thought it was cool, you know, like years later. Like bringing it up to my friends and being like, oh yeah, you know what? My family's more badass. Look at what the cops did to us. I know it sounds stupid and silly, but I'm a teen. I'm a little kid at that point. So mm-hmm. I'm just being real. The hardest part, I think, the hardest part was knowing as a young kid that you can't trust the cops for anything and that you never call the cops for anything because as Muslims, they're going to assume that we're perpetrators and we're dangerous regardless of what's true. So, you know, every time that I was like in some kind of situation where I needed to call the cops, I never would. And I don't know any other Muslims that would either at that time.
you know, there's a ton of journalism, there's a ton of documentation about how mosque leaders felt they had to change after 9/11. They had to do more outreach to the non-Muslim community around them. Did you see that at your family's mosque?
Oh my God, yeah. In like a very physical way afterwards. The mosque that I went to, Ghazali, they would do interfaith programming. They would ask some of the students at the school, like, to go to the synagogue or to the local church, like, just to meet other students and do, like, photo ops and, like, that kind of thing, and do outreach and, like, teach them about Islam and learn about Judaism and Christianity. And so they were very interested in, like, proving to the rest of the society that we were just like them and just as willing to build bridges and to, like, build a better society. Just after 9/11, they had brought a huge box of tiny little American flags to hand out to everybody. I think the mosque was aware that some people might be afraid to be the only ones not showing their patriotism, or how it would look if we were the mosque that didn't have a flag. That's how I thought it was. I thought it was like a self-defense thing. I don't know if like the guy who brought the box was like, yeah, go America. I don't know. It's possible. But in my mind, having experienced everything that day and the day after and all that, I just knew that this was like a little bit self-defense.
What was the fear that would be articulated in the mosque?
The fear was we have to protect ourselves and specifically Muslim women who wore hijab, because they were disproportionately being like harassed and being like physically assaulted in the streets. So there was this moment where the imam was like, look, if you don't want to like wear the hijab, that's totally fine. Like, we understand, come see us and we'll like talk you through that or anything. And so I know a lot of women who stopped wearing hijab after that moment. But I knew also women who wore it even harder and wore like the more aggressive kind because they wanted to basically make their stamp and make it known that they weren't afraid of being harassed. You know, so everybody was processing it in their own way, but I think the mosque was mostly worried about women who were vulnerable to hate crimes. And it happened on the mosque property. There was one woman who was going into her car in the parking lot, and a gang of people basically crept up behind her and punched her in the back of the head, you know, and then ran off like cowards. And, you know, we all knew people that had had like their cars smashed or people throwing stuff at us. And even the mosque itself, like several times, had like bomb threats phoned in.
How did it change the way you practice your faith?
I mean, that's a big question, right? I mean, especially since I don't know what life is like as like an American teen who not outside of 9/11, you know, like, I don't know what that's like. So for me, I almost wonder how different it would be too. And one of the things that I think is a consequence of 9/11 was that it gave every pundit and every politician license to talk about Islam and Muslims as like this theoretical thing, right? They can talk about Islam without actually talking to Muslims. And it wasn't until years later, so many years later, Mary, where people were finally bringing Muslims to talk on their programs about Islam. So for that whole period after 9/11, where Pamela Geller and Ayaan Hirsley Ali and all of these like anti-Muslim activists, they just had free rein to make their case basically that Islam and America are at war with each other, and that if we accept Muslims as regular Americans, we're signing our death warrant. And so I'm now, as a Muslim, I can't just respond to my faith ordinarily. I need to first respond to how people will respond to me as a Muslim before I can even get to how do I feel about this one verse or that verse. And doubly so for Muslim women who wear hijab, who they're not just responding to their faith anymore when they're wearing a headscarf. Now they're also responding to the ways that people observe their practice and what people might assume about them because of what they're wearing. You know, it's like a lot of work to get to the baseline where you can start responding to something on a spiritual level because of how politically charged everything you do as a Muslim is in this country.
You know, what's interesting is you refer to pundits a lot, and not just in this conversation, in your work. You've interviewed many journalists, and, you know, I rarely think about pundits. To me, they're highly ignorable, very easy to ignore. And it's occurring to me that that's a privilege, because usually the pundits are not talking about me, and they're not talking about my community.
Yeah.
So I get to ignore them. And you probably felt like you had to keep tabs on what they were saying about you.
I mean, how many people do you think watch Tucker Carlson tonight?
I have no idea. Millions.
Yeah, over 4 million. Every night he has that many people watching. And, you know, he's conditioning these people to feel a certain way about me and my mom and my kid and everybody that I know in my community. So that matters, and that means something, because on a regular basis, I interact with the people who watch that show. You know, I was at the January 6th Capitol riot. Mm-hmm. Not as a participant, I swear. I was there as a journalist. And, you know, there was one family that were there. They were from Greece, actually. And I like approached them because they were doing like a Mediterranean dance that was like familiar to me because my family's from Egypt. It almost looked like a debka. And so I was like, oh, what's their deal? So I started a conversation with them. And I told them that looks like a familiar dance to me. And they basically engaged me with my identity because of that. And they asked me if I was Muslim. I said, yeah. And the response I got was, well, something we don't really understand. Could you please explain this to us? I said, sure. They said, why were you celebrating after 9/11? And I was like, where did you hear that? And they were like, well, it happened. Like, Trump talked about it. And Tucker Carlson said that it was true. And Sean Hannity had like video. And I was like, okay. I was in Jersey City during that time. My whole family had tears in our eyes because we thought our father had died. And that I could tell you is for a fact that nobody in our community were celebrating. In fact, many people from our community had family who were first responders. And we weren't clapping. We were looking for places to donate blood. We weren't cheering. We were too busy trying to see how we can help our community that was being under attack. And this is just a side of the story that they've never even once considered, because they've been conditioned to think of the Muslim community as this organism that is feeding off of their society. So it matters to me because I need to know how to argue against those points that are being made on this show, because that's part of my lived reality as an American Muslim.
We're going to take a quick break. More with Ayman Ismail in a minute.
This episode is brought to you by Discover. When it comes to your finances, Discover wants you to know they are the credit card that is always there for you. With 24/7 US-based live customer service, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, that means no more waiting for, quote, normal business hours just to get a hold of someone. We are talking real service from real people whenever you need it. Get the customer service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket. So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
In the years after 9/11, you went to high school and then college, and you started a career in journalism. And in those years, you also kind of had a rebellious phase. You write about, you know, being really interested in pop culture and kind of a more secular life. I'm thinking of the photography you did earlier in your career. It has this kind of rogue feel to it. You even got arrested for trespassing in the course of one photography shoot, I think.
Yeah.
It just has all the hallmarks of a rebellious phase guided in part by youth, but perhaps by something else. And I was just curious why you felt safe enough to rebel.
So going to a private school and then going to a public school, all of that really had an effect on me, obviously, right? I couldn't just be a kid in your class. I needed to also like be ready to like argue with the tenets of Islam because so many people had like crazy ideas of what they were. And so like you had like 11, 12 year olds being like, Ayman, what is jihad? And like, why does your family want to kill my family? Like questions like that. And you sort of need to be like ready to answer those things. It's a lot of responsibility. So all of that responsibility at a certain point gets really, really, really heavy. And when I got to college and I was just like surrounded by all these really interesting opportunities to do all these new things that I've never tried before, I just wanted to dump all that weight off my back and just dive into something new.
And not be the Muslim ambassador anymore?
Yeah, I was tired of it. I just couldn't care less at that point about being your Muslim. So yeah, I mean, and with that came like a taste of a new life, and I just kind of dove headfirst in. Like I was never really great with the keeping up on the daily prayers. At that point, I had just like just given up. I was like, I wasn't even thinking about it anymore. I was just thinking about what's the coolest thing I could do today, and how do I get like a really cool photo that nobody else has ever gotten before. And I really got into like graffiti culture. It's really hard if you grew up in the tri-state to not get into graffiti. But this was my moment where I was like, I had the coolest camera. I was able to like skate so I could keep up with these kids and like go to places where most other people like only see after the fact. And I was going to the city every night, and I met all these like really awesome graffiti writers that I had looked up to. And so I just got like thrust into this like really crazy, like illicit underground culture. And I loved every second of it. Like I was obsessed. I thought that like graffiti and photography gave you the keys to the city.
But grabbing the keys to the city was more dangerous for Ayman. He was breaking the rules for sure, but he was singled out for harsher scrutiny. He remembers one story he did that landed him in especially hot water.
There was like this moment that the photography scene in New York was having where everybody was taking these really beautiful, breathtaking pictures from the tops of these bridges. And so I really wanted to do that. And when I found an opportunity to do so, I was a journalist working at this like graffiti culture magazine called Animal New York. So I had met this kid who climbs bridges, and I was like, yo, let me just shadow you for a night. Show me how to climb this bridge. I'll go with you and we'll like take pictures and we'll do an interview along the way. He was like, bet, come through. And it was amazing. And so that was that. Like I climbed down, published the pictures, wrote the story. It was like quoted in a whole bunch of other articles. The New York Times linked to it. It was like a big deal for me as a journalist. But then months later, like this happened in November, and then like March next year, a bunch of detectives showed up to my apartment. I wasn't there, but my roommate called me in a panic being like, yo, Ayman, there's like four detectives here. They want to ask you questions. I'm like, okay, that's weird. But like my whole life experience told me that for Muslims, this is normal. So at that time I was just trying to calm my roommate down, being like, yo, I'll be back soon. Don't worry about it. I called the number that the detective left, gave it to a lawyer, talked to a lawyer. The lawyer was like, there's no way around it. They're mad. You gotta turn yourself in. So I do. I turned myself in that same night. But then they start asking me questions about like what mosque I pray at. And like, if I know such and such person with like a Muslim name, or am I involved in whatever organization? And I'm thinking to myself like, okay, they just are really interested in the Muslim part of this, whatever is going on. And for people who don't know, trespassing is a misdemeanor. So even if they had caught me in the act, they would have written me a ticket and given me a summons, right? I would show up to the court date. In this case, they had slapped cuffs on me and they wanted to hold me overnight. And I was like, whatever, one night, maybe it's because I turned myself in at night. No, it ended up being a 36-hour ordeal where they had kept me in the tombs.
The downtown jail. And it's awful by every account.
Yeah, it's not fun. But what was special about that experience was that when I walk in, everybody has eyes on me and I'm like, I walk in, they take the cuffs off, I go in the cell and I'm like, Assalamu alaikum. There's like the Muslim greeting and everybody in the cell goes, Wa alaikum assalam. Like everybody there was Muslim. I was like, this is weird, but like a huge relief, you know?
It's like you walk into the Cheers bar.
It's kind of, yeah, everybody there was my brother in Islam, which was cool. Not cool because of like how we all ended up there, but cool in the sense where I wasn't like scared anymore.
How did the arrest get resolved?
So here's what happened. After asking me all these questions and then like asking me if they one of them bluntly asked me if I knew about any terrorist threat that was coming up.
An officer asked you.
A detective, right. A plainclothes detective without a lawyer present, by the way. And I'm like, listen, I live in the city. I have a job in the city. My family's here. If I knew about anything, I would say something. So then after 36 hours, I get to finally see a judge. And the judge goes, if you get in trouble like this again, we're going to deport you. And I was like, deport me? And I don't know if people who haven't been arraigned, you don't know this, but you can't talk. It's not like Law and Order where you have like a representation and you can like, it's not a trial. Right. So I'm still cuffed and you can't talk. And the judge just has their fact sheet and they're supposed to make a ruling in like 30 seconds. Everything on that fact sheet was a lie. They told them that I resisted arrest and that I was making instructions for people on how to climb bridges, which sounds crazy. Right. Especially if the person has a Muslim name. Now it sounds like something crazy. And then I find out later that it wasn't just the NYPD, the FBI. I don't know about the FBI. It was a Homeland Security, Port Authority. And the NYPD all had interest in this case. And I needed to take thumbprints for everybody because I was going into everybody's database. And there was like a news story about it later on ABC. And they had interviewed a bomb expert, like a terrorism expert, who made the case saying that if I wanted to, I could have gone up there and blown the bridge up.
But see, that whole story, that's like the perfect example of something that, you know, I would never climb on top of a bridge to take a picture, which perhaps hurts my journalism. But it also, like, I'm kind of stunned that you, after so much reason to think that the government would fuck you up if they caught you doing something, anything remotely wrong, I'm surprised you did it. Like, I don't understand that impulse. It strikes me as, like, there's something going on there. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Do you understand that impulse?
Yeah. I mean, and it's a push and pull and every day it's different, right? And this happens to any Muslim and they'll tell you this too, that sometimes you forget that you are like some sort of pariah to the community because you don't see yourself as a pariah. And, you know, Muslims, especially in the tri-state, do so much charity work. They do so much good for the community. And when you talk to normal people who know us, they love us. And it's not a big deal. So you sometimes forget that there are bad cops out there and bad judges and bad COs who want to abuse you because they might, you know, have their own personal beef or who knows what's in their heart. But like you sometimes forget. And I was so wrapped up into this like photographer community where the people who knew me had no problem with me. So I could sometimes forget that I'm like this dangerous person or I'm supposed to be. Like my dad said right after, he called me an idiot. He was like, how could you let them catch you? Like, why would you think for a second that this wasn't going to happen to you? And I was like, you're right, Bubba. Like this is, it was my fault in the sense where I forgot. I let my guard down.
Talk to you about how your family responded to the post 9/11 years. Did they struggle with these years and question U.S. government actions the way you seem to have done?
Yeah, I think so. I don't think any of us got out of it unscathed. My sister has a worse experience than I do. It happened to her when she was trying to go to Israel as part of like a school trip when she was at Harvard Law School. And they really messed with her out there. I feel really bad about what they did to her. They like borderline tortured her by like refusing to feed her and like gave her only milk with tea with milk for like the several days that they held her.
Who held her?
The Israeli Defense Forces, because she wore a headscarf at the airport. That's basically what happened. American citizen, American passport. But even she came back and she was like, I forgot that I'm a Muslim woman and that how could I have thought that I was going to just go on this school trip? but I mean, we all tend to like live our lives as messed as we can and do as much as we can. And then something happens where we're like brought down to earth, where we're reminded that we're just not ever going to be accepted as innocent by these like government agencies. We are inflicted with this like weight where we have to carry this around now, this like trauma. But at the same time, in order to survive and move past it, we have to just like manage and make do, because we can't just sit around and think about how life sucks for us as Muslims. That's just, we're not going to get anywhere. I don't know. We all handle it in our own ways. My parents are just, at this point, they're still just like good people. They're just so grateful to be in America. They love it here. They love the life that they've made here. They love the lives that their kids have made here. And I don't know any Muslim parents that really like resent the government or anything like that. They're all just happy to be here.
Yeah, it's kind of an immigrant family cliche at this point that a lot of times the parents who immigrate are really happy to be here, you know, like big time Ringo attitude, like just happy to be in the band, you know, like quite patriotic about their adopted country. And then it's the first generation American kids. You see these first gen kids who view the U.S. through more skeptical eyes. It sounds like that's true in your family, too.
Yeah. And I think the reason why is because their mission was to plant roots here and to grow a family here. And by that measure, they've succeeded, right? They, no matter what anybody says about them on TV, that doesn't change the fact that they have a family here. But for us, for me and my siblings and for people who were born here, that's not our goal. We're already here. So we're thirsting for something more. We want acceptance. We want truth. We want people to see through the bullshit in another way. You know, we want to help people who hate us to learn who we are. So we're doing this for y'all. You know what I mean? We know that we're not terrorists.
Ayman Ismail, thank you so much for talking.
Thanks, Mary.
Ayman Ismail is a staff writer at Slate Magazine. For the curious, look up his old video series. It's called Who's Afraid of Ayman Ismail? You can find it on YouTube. That's the show. What Next is produced by your heroes and mine, Davis Land, Elena Schwartz, Danielle Hewitt, and Carmel Del Shad. Special thanks to Ethan Brooks for helping us out this week. Allison Benedict is Slate's executive editor, and Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer of Slate Podcasts. Tomorrow, in the feed, What Next TBD with Lizzie O'Leary. She'll be talking about the Colorado River and the water crisis out west with Abram Lustgarten. I'm Mary Wilson, in for Mary Harris. Thanks for listening.